announcements and such. I think I sent email out that you should have gotten. There's a midterm survey that we like to give, which is really meant to give something in midterm evaluation to the TAs. And we do have a midterm get together with them where they look through this stuff, so it is fed back to them. And we also use it, even if you're very happy with your TA, we also actually use it to as a basis for TA awards and things like that. So I and the department would be grateful for you to take a moment and do that. I think there is a place where you can come in on the course or me in general. You're welcome to. That usually gets back to me. But generally, the main place for you to do that is at the end of the term. But if there's something you think is useful now, feel free to do that. As far as I know, I want to lift up my hands. And you never know what's going to come out in these evaluations. It's absolutely amazing. When you get the stack of them, it's good to go into your office, close the door, and read them. Because some of them are absolutely hysterical. And, you do read for trends, so they are useful. But at any rate, sometimes it's amazing what you guys remember and write down. I have looked through the submitted regrade requests. I think I've even looked at the homeworks that a few of you have handed me and adjusted those. The regrade requests I will have here and will hand to you in class, or you can drop by my office and get them. I just have a couple of comments because I've gotten some emails and a number of people have come by, and there's sort of this pattern that keeps going. The way I like to work it is I can't think about it if you're talking to me. I have to go away and look carefully at what you wrote. So if you submit a regrade request, I will look carefully at that problem. But having done that, I will grade it accordingly, right? So I won't take points away unless I start getting a lot of frivolous requests. But it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get what you asked for, okay? You might just not understand the problem, or the TA might be absolutely correct or incorrect, but there might be another problem that they didn't comment on. Maybe they missed it, but I saw it. Or, et cetera. There are a number of reasons. So you need to pick up your regrade and actually look at what I wrote. If I disagree with you, I will write a note on that, and you should look at that note, see what I wrote. So when you pick it up, it's not really an invitation to negotiate. All right, look and see what I wrote. Go away, think about it a little bit. If you then think you have an issue with it, feel free to hand it in again as a regrade, and we'll talk about it. If at that point I disagree with you, well, sometimes reasonable people disagree, and I'm in it because I'm a professor. But that doesn't actually happen very often, generally. So I have no vested interest in depriving you of points. I just want everything to be fair and reasonable evaluation. So, in fact, sort of the opposite. If I do err, I'm usually trying to err in your favor a bit. But okay. So, any questions with that? Is that not clear? Okay. All right. So, last time we were talking about energy. Well, I'm going to totally nail myself on this. I want every day. We talked about energy conservation and. There is an equation you'll certainly see used in the book, which is the non-conservative work is equal to the change in kinetic energy plus the change in potential energy for some system. And I think this can be a fairly confusing equation in some ways because you have to more or less get the signs right. In general, what this means is friction or the hand of God or something that is outside the system or that is not easy to sort of figure out where the energy is going. So with friction, you have friction in problems, the energy is lost to sound, heat, etc., deformation of the surfaces, and it's really hard to quantify. So in general, we call it non-conservative. Sometimes if there's a force from outside the system coming in, that would also be non-conservative. At any rate, conservative systems are things that, when in isolation, the energy can flow from sort of the potential form, the kinetic form, etc., in a way that is fairly easily quantifiable. And you can sort of think of it as ultimately being easily understood to be conserved. Energy is conserved, but in almost anything that you have in real life, some of that energy will go off in forms that you can't really quantify that easily. So in the case of springs, that is one conservative system that we talked about, and then gravity is the other conservative system. So in springs, we've talked about them as you compress or extend them at a distance x. If I take this natural length x0, if I define that to be 0, then the force, which is a vector, is a restoring force. It depends on the strength of the spring, and it depends on the degree to which it's been stressed or compressed. And it will always push back toward the center. When you write it down mathematically and use vector form, the always push it toward the center is y is minus sign is there. The net force is always going to be positive. Generally speaking, I think if you throw that minus sign in there, you will find it confusing. So I suggest that you always think of the force of the spring as a magnitude kx, and then take the direction according to how you see the problem and put that direction in the free body diagrams and everything, knowing that, without sort of throwing this additional minus sign in. It's fairly similar to something that is a common mistake, and some of you did it on the exam, where you do a free body diagram and everything, and you maybe write mg positive down in this particular problem, and then when you substitute in for g, you use minus 9.8. When you do that, you have just set down negative. Right, because that minus sign and the direction you chose to record it, that's the same information. So you're double counting it, which means when you throw in that minus sign, you're mixing it up. This is the same way. If you take the information that the spring is pulling a certain way and you put that in your axis with the algebraic sign appropriately, you do not want to put the magnitude of that force in with this minus sign, because then you're double counting. Okay? So just be really cautious about that. We looked at the amount of work it takes to stretch the spring out a small distance, and then we added those up with an integral, and we found the total energy that you take, that a spring gets, the potential energy that is stored in the spring, depends only on the degree to which it is extended or compressed, and it goes as 1/2 kx squared, usually written without the x0. But this I wrote because x0 is the natural length of that spring. So everything is referenced with respect to that. So if that doesn't happen to be 0 in your problem, you need to make sure that you've got it appropriately in that term. But if you take x0 equal to 0, then it just goes as 1/2 kx squared. Pretty easy to remember because it's fairly similar to, you know, 1/2 mv squared, which is kinetic energy. So it's sort of, for some reason, at least with my colander brain, I can remember that one. So we looked a bit more at energy, and for the spring, for example, as we change the length here, we're changing the amount of energy stored in the spring. And so if we graph that function of how the energy depends on what the position of the spring is, then you get a curve that looks something like this. It actually would touch the axis here, so that's a little bit misdrawn. But that would be a quadratic, 1/2 kx squared. So as you go out in x, this goes as a quadratic form. And if k is large, then this is going to be steeper. That is, you get more force if you pull it out a smaller distance, right? And if k is very weak, then this is going to be very shallow. It turns out that the potential energy function is something that's very fundamental and very useful. I believe that we will not go overboard with it this term, but I want to spend a moment talking to you about it, and we will do a little bit with it. Part of my reason for that is because it becomes extremely fundamental with everything you're doing next semester, and you'll do a whole lot with it. So just to give you a feeling for it, if you look at this, if I quantify how this energy changes as I change x, basically by looking at the derivative of x, it turns out that the negative of the derivative is equal to the force along that direction. So if you want to think about it, as I pull this thing out, I'll have a slope. That slope is positive on the right-hand side here. The force is negative, so that's why I have a minus sign in. But it turns out that the force is actually equal to that slope. You might say, well, how do you know that? We did some hand-waving work to sort of show it should be plausible. But in this case, for example, here's my energy function. If I take the derivative of it, it's equal to kx, which is the force. So it turns out this is a general statement. This is very particular to one direction. This thing is always true in three dimensions. So in general, along a one-dimensional problem, you have a simple derivative. So if you ask, what is the force along direction x, y, z, r, whichever direction it is you choose, you can take the derivative of that energy function with respect to that direction, put in the minus sign, and you have a force. We will do a little bit with the potential function of this term, just to give you a little preview, though, of why we will at least be what we're doing with it. In electromagnetism, if you have two electric charges, there'll be a force between them. We call it Coulomb force. And a way that we tend to quantify it is we say that there is a force per unit charge. That you can sort of say this charge creates a condition in space over here such that there's a force on that charge. And we call that condition, we call it an electric field. So we end up visualizing, and we're going to do gravitational fields, so this may make more sense. And we end up visualizing that every point in space you basically have a vector field that if you put a charge there, the charge times that field would give you the force on that charge. So it's a way of sort of quantifying electric fields. It turns out that everything you're doing, a lot of what you do in the first half of Physics 114 is trying to figure out how to calculate these fields, because if you calculate the fields, then you know what happens to the electric charges and you solve electromagnetism. And that's sort of the game. The thing is, electric fields are vectors, and vectors are hard. But you can take, you can look at the energy function, which we call electric potential in electromagnetism, and that's a scalar, just like the energy here is a scalar. 1/2 kx² is just an amount. It only depends on how much this is stretched. And if you can understand how the energy goes, you can take the derivative of it, and out will pop something which is actually a vector. This is a force in one dimension, so if I did it in all three dimensions, I would actually have a vector force. So this idea of using the energy function, or what you'll often call in electromagnetism, the potential function, to calculate something much more complex, typically the vector field, is a fairly standard thing. And so that's one of the reasons why we go through this exercise of trying to visualize the energy function, because very often it's a little bit easier to understand, and certainly a lot easier to calculate. Okay, so that's sort of where we've been. Any questions on that? All right. So what I'd like to do now is to turn and go back to chapter 6, if you've been looking at the book, and talk about gravitation. And, it's not a history course, but I do want to give you a little bit of perspective about what probably was one of the most magnificent moments in human experience of describing that. So, science is a very observational thing, and I think when people tried to visualize what the universe was like, what did they do? They looked out at skies, and it's actually sort of sad. Most of us live in places where we can't see the skies very well. But if you've ever been out in Vermont or Arizona or someplace on a really clear night when away from a city, the sky in good conditions is absolutely stunning. And in a world where you don't have MP3 players and cell phones and televisions and electric lights, what are you going to do at night? You're going to sit and watch the sky, and it actually turns out to be very dynamic. Even here with lights, I got a hot tub and sit out and have a beer and just sort of sit and look up at the sky. And if you actually do that and you let your eyes get adjusted to the dark, the number of satellites you can see going over is just amazing. I mean, is that, that's not dynamic in a natural way, but it's very cool. And if you see the space station go through, it's really an amazing sight. So people were very familiar, much more familiar in the old days with the sky than we are now. And it's sort of funny because we now know much more about what those things are, but in terms of actually observing the sky, they were much more adept at it. So it's not crazy, right? You go out there and everything goes around us. But some of the things move at different rates. So the planets move at different rates around us than the stars. The planets move relative to the stars. So you can imagine it's not crazy to put the Earth at the center of things in the great universe. And the moon clearly goes around. It goes at a different rate than the planets. But far in the distance, you have the stars. You see the planets are moving sort of relative to those. So this idea of having concentric circles with things on them is not so crazy. Circles were important because in the early days, the Greeks really valued perfect geometry things, and circles were sort of, spheres were sort of the most perfect shape you could have. So it's hard to imagine that a god or the gods would work with anything less than that. So here's a picture of sort of that early universe. You've got the Earth at the center, there's the Moon, Mercury, Venus, the Sun, Mars, etc. So this picture is pretty well documented. But as people looked at it a little more carefully, there were some things that didn't quite fit into this picture. Even if you had different spheres where things might be moving at different rates, there were some pretty odd things to look at. You had to have multiple spheres because in the sky, things would move relative to one another, and there are instances where things seem to move backwards. So it turns out if you carefully look at the planets over time, relative to the starry background, they will move in one direction. But now and then, you'll get what's called retrograde motion, particularly with Mars, where it's going this way, and then as you watch it over a period of a month or so, it goes backwards relative to the stars, and then it comes back forward. And that's sort of hard to picture if you have all the planets on a sphere and the stars on a sphere, because you now have Mars moving with respect to it. And what's happening is that happens during a period where Earth is coming through this part of its motion when Mars is over here. And if you think about what's happening relative to the starry background, it turns out that if you sort of visualize the fixed points in the distance, and you think of what you see in Mars as you go in your circle around it, you'll find that Mars will have this funky motion. Okay, so it really, the retrograde motion really is by virtue of the fact that we have Earth orbiting the Sun and Mars orbiting the Sun with Mars outside of the Earth's circle. So it's natural from how we look at it. But in a day where Earth was at the center, this is pretty strange stuff. So the only way to fix that is to sort of create multiple spheres. And the whole idea of having the Sun at the center of things actually was quite old, okay? 300 BC, there was a heliocentric universe proposed, but for lots of reasons, are you crazy? I mean, I think you have a lot of complicated issues with the heliocentric universe. You know, what holds you? Everything is drawn to the center. Why aren't you falling off if you're not at the center? So, in the spirit of sort of saving the theory but improving it, Ptolemy came up with a cosmology in about 100 AD, which lived for about 1,500 years. And in this cosmology, he explained the retrograde motion that was seen in some of the planets by putting epicycles on top of the circle. So you would have a standard circular motion, and then you might have another circle sort of running on that one. And with this kind of scheme, you could actually duplicate the motion of the planets. And So I forget how many circles and cycles it took, but in the end, by the time this Ptolemaic model, you know, by the time you're in the Middle Ages and it had been pretty fine-tuned, I can't remember, but it was something like 96 different circles and spheres it took to sort of make everything duplicate above the scene. But it worked pretty well, actually. So Copernicus is the one who is really credited with the heliocentric universe, which has fed into Western thought. And he published it on Revolutions of Heavenly Spheres late in his life. And in this, he came up with this heliocentric universe. But I wanted to bring up a couple of points about this. I think very often we think of the Copernican Revolution as really important in terms of science because it takes us away from the center. And we sort of think of this Copernican Revolution as maybe coming up against some religious ideas and such because it, to us it seems as if we're demoting man from being in the center of things. And putting them out. And I think in a while after this thing came out, it was like that. The church did have problems with it. And they did go to war with Copernicus. But initially, that really wasn't how it happened. Man's sort of dirty and sinful, so deserves to be in the muck in the middle of things. Remember the heavens, that's good. So part of the issue people had with this initially was, you're promoting Earth to the heavens? Are you kidding me? And now that you're up there, why aren't you falling off the sphere? I mean, what's holding you in? Because everything's attracted toward the center. And on top of that, this picture using circles didn't actually agree with the data all that well compared to the Ptolemaic model. So this was not adopted overnight. Okay, and it did get the additional complications of religious issues and such coming into play, but it took some time and it took some science to actually get it. Here's a picture of that you can't see very well, but it'll be in the slides. It's sort of science at work. In time, people made observations that showed they agreed with the heliocentric model. One happened to be when the telescope was invented, when Galileo took the telescope and turned it to the skies. There were two very particularly different pictures of what Venus should look like in the two pictures. If the sun is at the center, here's Venus. Okay, and you're going to see the phases of Venus. When Venus is over here, Venus will look full. When Venus is over here relative to Earth, you'll begin to see Venus have phases like the moon does. If you're in the Ptolemaic picture, remember Venus is on a circle that's closer to Earth than the sun. And Venus does have an epicycle or whatever, but basically, when Venus is near the sun, you're going to see Venus all this stuff. The phases you see here are going to be very different. And so, Galileo saw that Venus had very clear phases with time. On top of that, there's an astronomer, Tycho Brahe, who was Danish. He did enormously careful observations over many years of the positions of the planets and took very careful records. And Johannes Kepler actually worked with him basically as an intern. And they found that Brahe's data didn't really fit that well with Copernicus's theory. But Kepler, because he had worked with Brahe, he actually had access to this really good data, the best in the world. And he studied it and realized that the data fit very well if you allowed for elliptical orbits. And this is no small thing, right? Why in the world would the gods choose an ellipse instead of a circle? So this is a pretty major step. But it was at this point the heliocentric model fit the data vastly better than the Ptolemaic model. And Kepler then effectively derived from the data what the planetary orbits look like, and he came up with three mathematical laws that quantified them, and they're in a section of your book, Kepler's Laws, and we're not going to worry about them. I'm not going to test you on those, but just be aware of what they are. They basically describe the orbits and related the periods and the axes and the areas of the ellipses. So then along came Newton. And Newton studied lots of different things. And he was one of these amazing people that almost everything he touched, he had great insights for. So he was truly was an amazing individual. But he, at some point, came up with what he called the universal law of gravitation. And he was able to then effectively derive Kepler's three laws from this idea that there was some force of nature, which was quantified by the form gmm over r squared. If you have two masses separated by a distance r, and this is a constant that you derive from experiment. So he has this idea, and from this he could use it with his three Newton's laws to describe things like projectile motion on Earth. But then he could also take this and he could derive Kepler's laws from it. And I want you to just think for a moment about what a moment that must have been. I mean, it's quite one thing to say, okay, I can describe how the balls move around. But all of a sudden, this guy realized that this stuff that we're playing with on Earth is the same thing that is governing the motion of the planets. That's sort of a big deal, right? So, Newton had a pretty heady moment there, I guess. Anyway, so what I want to do now is to spend time with Newton's laws, Newton's law of gravity, and talk about it in some quantitative way. Newton has a very particular vision for what the force of gravity is. And in his vision, it's basically force at a distance. Imagine if I have two masses, say a big M and a little m, and let's say for a moment I want to ask, what is the force of gravity due to big M on little m? We operate from the center of the masses, let's assume they're uniform, and I will put down a vector going from the center of big M to the center of little m, which I'll call R. Then Newton's law of gravitation says that the force of big M on little m is equal to minus g times big M times little m times the unit vector r, which just says it's along the r direction, divided by the distance squared. What does the minus sign mean? I mean, have you ever heard of negative gravity? So what do you really mean here? This is a force of magnitude dmm over r squared, so it depends on how much mass you've got in the two bodies. It depends on the distance, inverse square. It has some constant, which we call this big G, the gravitational constant, for lack of any better name. And this is a number we evaluate experimentally. This minus sign tells you that the force of this particle on that particle is along the direction minus r. So that minus sign is what makes gravity attractive. Again, I think you want to be cautious with that minus sign. You should just know that gravity is always attractive, and if you now put that direction in some free body diagram that you're doing, don't double count by then putting this minus sign in. Okay? So be careful with the minus sign, just like you are the strength.
It is a vector force. You need to always keep that in mind. So if we live in a two-dimensional world, and if I say that I have M1 here at a distance R1 from the center, and I have M2 here at a distance R2 from the center, and if I have little m here, the vector force on little m is the vector force due to this mass plus that mass, but there's some vectorial. So what happens is that the force on little m is going to be equal to g times m1 times m over R1 squared in the y-hat direction. That is, this mass will attract little m that way, plus gm2 times m over R2 squared in the x-hat direction. This one will attract this mass that way. And then depending on the details of the numbers, what that means is if I add this force and that force together vectorially, I end up with some net force like this. Right? So don't forget the vector part, especially when you have multiple masses in the problem. You okay with that? So, here's our force law, and if we have that, we can now ask to see, we can try to see if we can understand the energy in the system, like we did at the spring, by basically allowing a mass to move from one point to another, and see if we can understand how much energy is stored in the system relative to where the masses are. Okay, so let me start out with a big mass M here. And let's say that at some distance, which I'll call R1, I have a mass M. And what I'd like to do is to take this mass M and move it out along the radial line to a point up here, which will be at a distance R2. Alright? So think of them as collinear, but R2 is larger than R1. And in order to understand how the energy works for the system, what I'd like to do is to say how much work is done, and think by me, if I were to move little mass m from R1 to R2 in magnitude along a radial line for simplicity. Okay? So this is very similar to the spring problem in the sense that as I'm moving this mass, the work calculation isn't trivial, right? You can't just say, well, it's equal to the force times the distance, which is R2 minus R1. Why? Because that force is changing in magnitude. As I move away, I'm
moving further away, so the force is getting weaker. Alright? So, that's a hard problem.
So in order to make thinking about it a little bit easier, what I want to do is to consider one spot. So let's say here's where my R1 is, here's where my R2 is, and let's imagine that there is a spot here at some distance R, and we move out a distance ds in that direction, okay? And the amount of work we do to move out that distance ds is equal to the force that we have to exert on the particle dotted into the distance ds. ds and dr are basically the same axis, so I'm going to assume that the magnitude of a little ds and the magnitude of a little dr will be the same. If I'm moving the particle out, the force that I have to exert is away from the center of the mass. I'm moving it out, so ds is in the same direction. So f dot ds becomes the magnitude of the force times ds, or the magnitude of the force times dr. So that's how much work it takes. As I'm moving the mass out, I get it at some distance r from the center. That's how much work it takes to go to some little distance r plus dr. So it's a very tiny amount. Over that distance, I actually know what the force is because it can't change over a differential distance. So I know what the force is. And now all I have to do is to take all those little infinite number of dw's that I do as I move at an infinite number of little ds's and add them together, which is what we mean when we say we're doing an integral. So the total work that we have is equal to the integral from R1 to R2 of f dr. If I'm moving the mass out slowly, so we don't worry about it accelerating, and we just think of it as moving at a slow constant velocity, then the force that I have to exert is actually equal to the force that the mass is attracting with. So that means that the force is equal to GMM over R squared. And this is an instance where if at this point I throw in the minus sign, I'm cooked. Because the minus sign really just means it's an attractive force. And the moment that I say, in order to pull this mass out, I'm having to exert a force away from the mass, I have just taken that information into account. Right? So that directional information is already taken into account the minute that I do this dot product and come up with a positive sign there, because I say that the force I exert is in the same direction as the ds I'm going. So the work has the f dot ds is just f times s. If at this point you now substitute in this minus sign, you've now double counted it and you've blown it. Okay, so this is an example of why you have to be careful. So that's why I use the positive thing there. This is equal to G times M over nothing times this integral. The integral of 1 over R squared is minus 1 over R. Evaluate between R1 and R2. If I go ahead and pull the minus sign in, this is equal to minus GMM over R2 plus GMM over R1. So, woohoo. Is this a positive work or a negative work? Thank you.
which R is bigger. 2 is bigger, which means this is being divided by a bigger number. So this overall is smaller than this. So this is a net positive. You should be breathing a sigh of relief at that, because you should check yourself on these things. It better be positive, because I know that I have to do work. I have to increase the energy of the system to lift this thing away. Right? So when I calculate this, I better be getting a net positive number. So never get away from trying to think about what's going on, because sometimes that's your best clue that we blew a sign or something like that. Okay? So, just like we did with springs, what we have here is that the amount of work that we have to do to move from some point to some other point depends only on these endpoints. It depends only on those radii. And so, you might imagine that we can try to define a potential energy function, which would be useful. So let us define gravitational potential energy to be equal to minus G big M little m over R. If that's true, then what we have done is this work is the difference in the potential energy between one point and the other point. If we define potential energy like this. Okay? So, some of you might wonder what's going on here, because you're used to thinking that gravitational potential energy goes as mgh, or that's right. So we have to ponder that a little bit, because that's really not what we're seeing here. If we look at the energy function that we just said we have, and we look at how much energy is in the system as a function of R, it actually looks something like this. This would be the minus 1 over R form that we got. Just to sort of check ourselves a little bit, though, before we try to understand this piece, why don't we try taking this, and let's look at the derivative of this with respect to R. Minus the derivative of minus gmm over little r with respect to r. This would be basically taking the derivative of the energy function with respect to that direction, and let's see if we get the force. So the derivative of a minus 1 over r is a 1 over r squared. So this gives us minus gmm over R squared, which is the force that we put into it. So with this strange definition of gravitational potential, we have something that is consistent with Newton's law of gravitation and our understanding of how work will change the energy of the system as we move things. So now what I want to do is, so this is really the general case, and if you're dealing with masses and planets and spaceships that are far away from the surface of the Earth, you better be doing it with this form. But what I'd like to do is to take a moment and look at the other form that you're used to using and show that these two are actually consistent, even though they sort of don't seem that way. Every time that we've used little mgh to take into account to be the way the energy changes with gravity, I always specify as near the surface of the Earth. So let's imagine here's our Earth, and we have a little distance h here
where something is, you know, changing in terms of its height. And I'm going to say that we have the radius of the Earth is big R sub E, and I'm going to say this point is at a radius little r, which is equal to R sub E plus delta R, where this delta R is basically the same thing as H. Okay? And let's now look at this problem. The change in the potential energy as we go from the surface of the Earth to R sub E plus delta R. I think for fear that I don't want to change notation from something that I have written in notes, because I don't want to drop anything. So just to risk a little confusion right now, I'm also going to call this just plain R. And but that I'm now using little r is equal to, so let me take that. So you get to the height h when little r is equal to this r sub e. Sorry. Let me make sure I got this right. So the difference here, I'm calling h or delta r. This r sub e is the radius of the Earth. This r sub e plus the delta r, I'm going to call little r. So when you're at the height, we're going to say you're at a radius little r. And so that means what I want to do is to calculate how much energy it goes to go from R sub E to this R sub E plus little r, which is the same as R sub E plus delta r, which is the same as little r. Okay, so I think with that I took something absurdly simple and probably made it completely opaque. But if you look at what I wrote instead of what I said, maybe it makes sense to you. At any rate, if you followed that, the change in the potential energy will be equal to the potential energy that we end with minus that which we start with. And we've defined the potential energy function to be this minus GMM over whatever that R is. So this is equal to minus G times the mass of the Earth times the little mass, if we move a little mass here, over little r. So that would be where we end up. And we subtract from that the starting PE, which is minus GME times M over R sub E. And these quantities, no, these are not squared. Okay? So now I want to just collect terms. So this is equal to R times RE of minus G times M E M R R E plus G M E times little m. That's not an R here. Times little r. So this whole thing is equal to G times the mass of the Earth times little mass times R minus R sub E, if I did that right, over R sub E times R. So delta PE is equal to G times ME times little m. And what I want to do is now split the little r into its big component, the big component and its little component. So this will be equal to little r, but little r is equal to the radius of the Earth plus a little delta r.
So that's this little r becomes this, and then I pull down minus r sub e.
And that's divided by r sub e times little r, which we're substituting in as r sub e plus delta r. You with me so far? Now, if we say we are near the surface of the Earth, and the Earth is big, what we're really saying is that this little delta r is tiny compared to big r sub e, which means this term is effectively equal to just r sub e. And this, the r sub e's go away, so we have just the delta r, which is also what we call h. So this is equal to g times m sub e times little m times h over r sub e squared. And if you recall, way back when, we took this piece, and that is what we call g. So the change in the potential energy is equal to mgh when you're near the surface of the Earth. And so that actually can give you an idea of the realm in which that mgh equation is useful, and that would be in the realm where the height that you're considering is small compared to the radius of the Earth. Okay. And you will make error with it, depending on how precise you want to do the measurement or whatever. You may need to use the better form. You okay with that?
Professor Manley?
Yes.
How can we disregard the delta R on the bottom but not on the top?
Because on the top, the big R's cancel exactly, leaving only that incremental little piece. So I can't just ignore it at that point. On the bottom, that little piece is summed with a very, very big piece. So it's just not noticeable. So mathematically, one says that the delta R is negligible here, but I can't just ignore it there. If I ignore it there, then I'm making an approximation that the potential energy doesn't change as I go from one height to another, which in the cosmic scale of things is maybe true, but in the world where that change in energy makes a difference, we can't just throw it away. Okay? So we are going to do a little bit with gravitational fields, so let me at least give you a sense of what it is. Because Newton's law leaves a lot to be desired, actually. It works. It works really well. And, Lord, I hope Newton felt like a god when he figured it out, because it really is an amazing advance in our understanding of the universe. Mentally, it's a little bit, you know, what is the essence of the force? What does that really mean? I suspect many of you have stayed up late nights worrying about this. But it's actually sort of cool when you start to think about it. The picture that we have for forces in classical physics sort of works in the following way. What we say is that if we have some mass, I'll call it big M, and we have another mass at some point in space over here, I'll call little m, the way that we sort of visualize and quantify the field or the force is we say that this is big M. I mean, suppose I have big M in a little box, so you don't really know what's there. And I have a little mass over here. How in the world does this little mass know that that other mass is there? How does it know that there's a force there, right? So the way that you visualize this is that you say the big mass makes a modification in space around it in some strange way. And this is really pulled out of the air in the sense that it works. But here's the picture. What we say is that the big mass creates what is known as a gravitational field, which is a vector G. In mathematics and physics, when we talk about fields, what we're really talking about is, if you're thinking three dimensions, a three-dimensional space where a field is something where you have a value at every point in that three-dimensional space. So that's how you think of a field. So when I say gravitational field, that's sort of a catchword of saying every point in free space would have a value for this field. It could be zero, but it has some assignment. So there's a one-to-one correspondence between the field and the points in space. And what we say is that this gravitational field is really defined in such a way that it is equal to the force on the little mass at that point P, at that whatever point that is, I'll call it at point P, force on that little mass at point P divided by the magnitude of the mass at that point. So if you think about what that actually is, that is equal to minus G times big M over R squared in the R hat direction. So why do we do it this way? The force, as it's defined, depends on both masses and where they are relative to one another. Okay? Mentally, that's sort of hard to get around. So what we'd like to do to develop a concept of force is to say that this mass, in and of itself, does something to the space around it, such that if I take some other mass and put it here, there will be a force on it, which is toward that mass. Okay? And if it's closer, it will be stronger. If it's further away, it will be weaker. If it's over here, it'll be this way. If it's over here, it'll be that way. So that's the picture you want. The problem is you want that definition to depend only on that initial mass. You don't want it to matter, to care, what the other little mass is. When you do electromagnetism, you will call this thing a test charge. In this case, you have a test mass. Regardless of what the size of this mass is, I want to be able to put it in different places and see what the force is. Which means I have to define whatever is happening in space out there such that it depends only on that first mass. And that's why I divide out the magnitude of the little mass. Because now it only matters where I am. And once we've done that, then we define something which is called this gravitational field. This is now a vector field. So if you want to try to visualize it, when you look at a weather map, you see numbers, temperatures for different cities. That would be a scalar field. You could imagine that the weathermen have this big mapping where they have temperatures at every point in space along the surface of the Earth, and they pick out a few of those and they put them on their map, and that's what you see. Those are just numbers. They have a magnitude. In this case, we have magnitude and direction, so it's much more similar to something like what you might need if you're going to fly an airplane, which is wind, magnitude, and direction at every point in space. Okay?
And so in this case, we visualize it as a vector field, which means every point in space has a vector associated with it. If I want to know what is the force on a mass at that point, I can put the mass at that point. The vector direction tells me what the force would be, tells me the direction of the force, and the size of the vector would tell me the mass, would tell me the force when I multiply it by the mass. So a way to visualize that is, here's my big M. If I put a mass here, I'll have a big vector force. If I put a mass here, it's going to be much smaller because it drops as 1 over r squared. If I put it over here, it'll be like that. Put it over here, it'll be weaker. So you can sort of visualize what this force field would look like by putting the test mass in all different places. So if you think of the force is being conveyed by this gravitational field, which the initial mass sets up, then you begin to get a mental sense of how the force might work. We also get something else for free with this, which is, with this mental picture, we begin to look, instead of talking about what this mass is doing, we begin to talk about what is the condition of the space. In other words, you can conceptually now imagine having a gravitational field in space without necessarily knowing all the details about the mass over here that's setting it up. So this turns out to be, again, something in electromagnetism you use all the time, because the charge distribution may be complicated, but you will always be talking about electric fields in space and stuff. So this field stuff may seem very artificial, and it will very much so in electromagnetism when you're doing it. And by the time you reach midpoint in electromagnetism, if you're not believing in these fields as something real, something's probably wrong. So it is a mathematical convenience, but it turns out that these fields, although they're sort of calculational, there's a reality to them as you progress in the field and begin to use them. Yeah, sorry. Progress in the topic. That's very real. Okay, so to add a little substance to that, when you study light, what you'll find is it's basically waving electric and magnetic fields. Okay, and light is a very real thing, and our model of light works extremely well. And that model, as crazy as it sounds, is waving electric and magnetic fields. Okay, so it's a very bizarre sort of thing that I'm sort of talking about here. So, okay. So that's the idea of a gravitational field. You will be having some problems on that. Sorry, the batteries for this just died, so I'm going to yell. So I want to take a moment and talk a little bit more about this. This is the Newtonian view of the essence of the force. Newton's laws work really well. They describe, for example, the motion of the planets around the sun. It turns out that if you measure things really precisely, you'll find that Newton's laws don't quite work. For example, Mercury's orbit has a closest point to the sun that precesses, that is, it moves around the sun over many orbits. And if you do the astronomy very carefully, you'll find that Newton's laws don't actually get that quite right. So at the turn of the century, Albert Einstein came up with another theory of gravity, which we call general relativity. And that theory has a very different picture of how gravity works. In general relativity, Einstein noticed that there is an equivalence between an accelerated reference frame and a gravitational field. And you experience it every day. If you go on an elevator and the elevator starts going upwards, you feel heavy, right? And what Einstein said was, suppose that you are standing in an elevator
in the middle of space. There's no mass there, but the thing is accelerating at 1g upward. Would you ever know that you're not just standing on the surface of the Earth if there were no windows? And he hypothesized that the answer is no, you wouldn't. That this is called the equivalence principle. And it leads to some fairly strange ideas, one of which is, if you really believe in the equivalence principle, then these two conditions ought to be the same. And let's imagine what happens if you have, for example, you're in your elevator, which is actually on a rocket ship that's headed to the moon or whatever, and you fire a laser straight across the rocket ship. And this thing is accelerating at 1g. As if you think of the laser as a pulse of light, as it moves across, you're moving up. It moves across, you are accelerating, you're going up. So what that means is if you are standing in that elevator and you look at the light, you would actually see it go, if you were able to measure it, in a curved path like that. You okay with that? Do you see it? Because this thing is accelerating around it. As this thing goes straight, it's going to seem like it bends down. So by the equivalence principle, if you carry this to an extreme, what you're saying is that if you're on the surface of the Earth and you take a flashlight and a laser light and you do that, the gravitational field will bend the light. So that's what he says at the start of general relativity. If that's true, light, you know, goes in a straight line, so he's basically making the statement that gravitational fields bend space, or curved space. And that is the starting point for general relativity. I think if you haven't gotten accustomed to it, it sounds pretty wacky. But in fact, what he does is he then evaluates a universe where you can have states being quite malleable, and actually you can have straight lines that meet. You can have curved space, basically. And so it took him about 12 years to figure out the math and beef it up. But he came up with a theory of energy and gravity where you interpret gravity in terms of the force as being the curvature of space. And it turns out time also gets weird. So maybe somebody will talk to you about relativity in space and time in 114. I don't guess it's part of the purview of this class, but it's really absolutely cool stuff. But there's a very different mental picture of gravitation. This one, actually, if you go and you measure things, works very well. Do you give a crap? Most of you probably don't. Maybe you've never heard of this stuff, I'm sure. But you ought to give a crap, because if you don't have general relativistic corrections to it, the GPS system that we all use to get places doesn't work. It's revolutionized how we move. Revolutionized travel, revolutionized is really more of a military thing, right? If you can use GPS and make a bomb hit something within 2 meters, it changes how you do war. But it also allows you to find the nearest restaurant and stuff like that. But you can't make the GPS system work by a bunch of satellites that are around Earth and basically looking at the difference in timing of signals from different satellites, which you can only understand if you use the general relativistic corrections, the Newton's laws, in order to get those things right. Fortunately, you don't have to do it. Some engineers have done it. But it actually has changed the world. So Einstein's theory of general relativity seems to be better than Newton's theory. And then there's another theory of relativity, another theory of gravity I'm not going to tell you about. And sort of one of the things I wanted to sort of get you to think about a little bit is, you know, who's right? And what does it mean when you say Einstein's better than... Trust me, if I asked you to do a general relativistic correction for an inclined plane problem, you would not think that Einstein is better than Newton. You would hate his ass. Okay? What it means is that we have these different views. These views are made up by people. And then you do scientific observations to see what works. But really, you use the simplest model you can get away with. So we're not going to do anything with Einstein. You're going to be doing stuff with Newton. But Newton's stuff works just great at the surface of the Earth. It's an amazingly good theory. And one of the things people try to do is to test general relativity with greater and greater precisions, because maybe there's something that underlies it that will allow us to understand more about the universe than relativity does. And so, you know, this stuff that we're talking about, it's very easy to sort of think of it as if it is written in stone. But in fact, people sort of make it up. And it works, it's self-consistent, and you do have to learn it and know how to use it, because it really does seem to work. But it's science, nonetheless, and it is open to interpretation and making measurements. And I'm sorry, I'm sure I've put about half of you to sleep. I will not do this very often. You have any comments, questions, arguments? Okay. See you next time.